S5, E9 of Fanacek. I'm continuing my journey of exploring 80s TV shows and film as I experience them as a man in my late 40s. And this episode is called Things That Make You Go, Just kind of looking at some questionable choices made by some of my favorite 80s TV shows. So let's start with that. Let's talk about how shows are made first. A surprising amount of people are involved in developing a television show. You have the creators, writers, casting associates, network executives, producers, directors, etc., all those folks. The list is endless. No decisions are made without going through a committee of people who think they know exactly what the audience wants, what the audience needs, all that. So, as if building the Tower of Babel, all these people somehow complete a pilot episode, and I don't know how it gets done. Once the pilot is in the can, it gets scrutinized by test audiences who provide scores based on what they like, didn't like. Now, keep in mind that these test audiences are comprised of people who had nothing else going on that day, so typically unemployed folks. We're not talking about sophisticated folks here. The scorecards are then sent back to the executives, where it'll be either be kept as is, changed based on the audience remarks, or most commonly, shit canned, right? Sadly, most of the shows who have reached this point get scrapped, and they never see the light of day. The few survivors are sent out to the upfronts, right? So sponsors can be duped into spending their advertising budgets on these new artistic gems. Then finally, right, the new shows get a big marketing push and debut on the airwaves. Sounds like we're done, right? Well, you're wrong, because now it's time to start examining the ratings. Today's shows are not allowed to like slowly build an audience. Not at all. The executives need instant gratification, a large audience right away. Otherwise, the network is going to step in, either make changes or snap the show's neck for a quick death, just like that. So sadly, most of the shows that make it to your living room after all of this work and all of these people and all these brains thinking they know what's going on, most of these shows are not going to survive this first season, really, which isn't surprising since most of them suck. And it's not hard to tell when a show's being advertised if it's going to suck or not. So in the end, it's very, very expensive and wasteful. But every now and then it works, and the TV gods, you know, they smile down on us and provide us with 5 to 10 years of an awesome show that we tend to cherish forever. Some of these shows are perfect. I wouldn't change a thing. Shows like The Mary Tyler Moore Show, All in the Family, Cheers, The Simpsons, Seinfeld, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad. They all defied the odds and didn't allow those knucklehead executives to fuck them up. They are TV perfection, right? But that's not what this chapter is about. Everyone knows these shows are great. We don't need someone else to generate a list of great shows. That's been done 100 times. What I want to explore are shows that were winners, became a part of our collective lives, and are still part of the zeitgeist, but with some really questionable shit at their core. Weird plot holes or choices made, right? Maybe strange character arcs or cultural incongruities, whatever it may be. But basically, I want to talk about shows that made you go, at least they made me go, So let's get started. Let's start with a classic, an action-adventure show, The A-Team. Boy, did I love this show as a kid. I never missed an episode. I was obsessed. I had the toy van. I had A-Team stickers. I had a Mr. T doll. One of my birthdays was a Mr. T theme. I think the cake and the hats and the napkins and all that shit. Hell, I even ate the Mr. T cereal, and as I record this, I'm looking across my home office at a vintage Mr. T cereal box. That's the kind of shit I spend my money on, right? My friends, like when we were playing outside, we always pretended to be the A-Team. I was often face, because I thought pretty highly of myself, apparently. I would have been BA, but I lacked that certain something, I think, that Mr. T brings to the role. The great physique, the jewelry, all that shit. But here's the details about the A-Team. Let's start with some housekeeping stuff. The run. The A-Team premiered on January 23rd, 1983. It aired 97 episodes over 5 seasons before its finale on March 8th, 1987. The premise of the show... it was created by legend Stephen J. Cannell. And by the way, I did a couple episodes on Stephen J. Cannell. You can go back and listen to him. And I think it was season 3 or 4. I forget now. But he created shows like Beretta, The Rockford Files, Greatest American Hero, 21 Jump Street. The A-Team was an action-adventure episodic about 4 Vietnam vets framed for a crime they didn't commit. Now on the run from the military, they are vigilantes, soldiers of fortune for hire to help the innocent against evil oppressors. Let's talk about the cast. The legendary George Peppard is their leader, Lieutenant Colonel John Hannibal Smith. He loves it when a plan comes together. Mr. T, fresh off his star-making role as Clubber Lang in Rocky III as B.A. Baracus. I don't know that it's confirmed, but as a kid, we all assumed that B.A. stood for Bad Attitude. So Bad Attitude Baracus. Don't know if that's true or not. Dwight Schultz as the insane, howling mad Murdoch. And then the John Stamos-esque Dirk Benedict as Templeton Face Man Peck. And they all called him Face. So, what my thoughts? Here's some thoughts. Like I said, I loved this show. It was an unsophisticated hour for an unsophisticated audience. Luckily, I was not yet 7 years old when it premiered. Not that I'm much more sophisticated now, but I was the core audience. Each episode followed a pretty simple recipe. An innocent person or group are being bullied by a mean person or group. The innocents track down the hire the A-team. The A-team comes in and pushes back on the bad guys, but the bad guys are not willing to pack it in and give up. With their backs to the wall, the A-team then participate in a MacGyver-esque montage during which they take scrap metal, car parts, farm equipment, you name it, and build some sort of weaponized contraption used for a final confrontation with these pesky bad guys. That confrontation often involves a fist fight in which several people are thrown and fly over the camera in slow motion. That was a very popular shot in the A-Team. The camera's on the ground and the person flies over the camera. I've been in fights. I've seen fights. I've never seen a human being get thrown 15 feet across the air, though, but it is what it is. Also, automatic weapons, grenades, and dynamite are often used, but never fear. No one ever dies or is seriously injured. That was kind of a trademark. The A-Team wins. The bad guys are shit out of luck, and the innocent folks move on with their lives. Hannibal then smiles and tells us that he loves it when a plan comes together. Now, for added spice, the show would sometimes call a few audibles, such as B.A. having to be knocked out prior to a flight because he's scared of flying, Murdoch having to be busted out of a psychiatric facility, that happens sometimes, and then sometimes we get the military showing up and chasing the A-team, because again, the show was episodic, but the through line was that general, whatever the hell his name was, he was always chasing them, he'd show up every now and then, kind of like that the McGee, who was always chasing David Banner in The Incredible Hulk. But for the most part, the episodes were very predictable, which youngins like me enjoyed, but ultimately led to the show's demise because honestly, it kind of became too boring and the audience checked out. Let's talk about some fun facts before I get to the things that make you go stuff. Fun facts. The series was apparently conceived by NBC president Brandon Tartikoff, who pitched the idea to Stephen J. Cannell as a mix of The Dirty Dozen, Mission Impossible, and The Magnificent Seven, which completely makes sense. Definitely has a Dirty Dozen and Magnificent Seven vibes. George Peppard and Mr. T did not get along. It's a common tale, really. George was the big star coming into the show. He was a veteran of classic film and television, things like Breakfast at Tiffany's, Banachek, which is my namesake, right? It was understandable that he would be the big swinging dick on set until Mr. T quickly became the breakout star. George's show now became Mr. T's show, and the two stopped talking to each other. Happens all the time. Hulk Hogan appeared in two episodes during season four. Producers begged him to make more appearances because he was one of the few people who was friends with both George Peppard and Mr. T, and they felt that he could serve as a peacemaker between the two. Now imagine that. This already over-the-top show wanted to add Hulk fucking Hogan to the cast just to help these two knuckleheads get along. That's a lot. They should make a fucking movie about that. Just a movie about that. Like George Peppard at war with Mr. T, and they want to hire Hulk Hogan as the peacemaker. That just writes itself. I think I might produce that. So let's take a look at things that make you go, I already gave you this show's premise, but don't take it from me. The following is the exact dialogue that is narrated during the iconic opening theme song. I'm going to read it to you. In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team. Right, we've all know it. Now, there's one critical line here that's worth investigating. If you can find them. If you can find them, seriously? It shouldn't be too damn hard given the following aspects of this show. First, their van is likely the coolest, most recognizable van in all of Los Angeles, right? Besides Mr. T, the image of the 1983 GMC Vandura, which is called, was what it was called, It was black with a red stripe. It had red mag wheels and red rooftop spoiler. It is easily the most iconic aspect of the show, right? How the hell are they in hiding driving this thing around town? And keep in mind, the military knows what it looks like. A simple APB would likely result in the LAPD spotting them in around 12 minutes. Literally, just one APB, we stop the van. And while I'm at it, let me also make sure that Bo and Luke Duke get this memo, right? Why bother being an outlaw moonshiner if you're going to drive around in the most recognizable car in the whole fucking state of Alabama? It's bright orange with a Confederate flag, you assholes. And stop jumping it over various bodies of water, dumbasses. This is why you, your cousin, and your uncle end up in jail every other episode. Okay, now back to the A-team. Second thing, let's discuss Mr. T's look. This is a very large, muscle-bound black man. He would stand out in a crowd wherever he goes. Add to that a mohawk, right? Now he really stands out. Did I mention he's wearing long feather earrings? Because he is, and now he is super recognizable. And oh, by the way, he's wearing no less than 40 pounds of gold jewelry around his neck. And I'm not making that up. That is true. 40 pounds. I'm not exaggerating. It's not going to take fucking long to spot this dude, even in Hollywood. He's very recognizable. So let's pause for a moment. Let's pause. Was there never a team meeting to discuss the van and Mr. T's look? Did no one offer a suggestion of, you know, let's get a Ford. They make a Taurus now. It's going to blend right in. Let's get a Ford. Or how about this? Hey, BA, how would you feel... I love what you're doing, first of all, but how would you feel about growing your hair out and maybe putting the jewelry in a safe deposit box? I mean, I'm all for looking cool, except when I'm in an escaped convict accused of war crimes, in which case I focus more on just blending in, right? I mean, but it gets worse. Hannibal has a side hustle. That's my third issue here. Hannibal has a side hustle. When not hiding from the government or acting as a vigilante for hire, he likes to spend his time as a working actor. He's an actor. The guy's an actor in movies. Now, granted, his roles were often in low-budget horror films, but still working as an actor in a movie that, in theory, will be distributed to audiences across the globe, and it's possibly the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. I mean, you need a little walking around money? Get a job as a stock boy working the third shift in some store that no one goes to, right? This way you're not seen. Better yet, steal the money. What you don't do is take headshots, submit your headshots to casting directors, go in, read for roles, and cross your fingers hoping to get the fucking part. That's not how you hide from the government, man. All right, fourth thing. Last thing that really makes me go, about the A-team. I like the character, don't get me wrong. And I have nothing against people suffering or dealing with mental health issues, but they need to lose Murdoch. They need to look, granted, he's a pilot, and that comes in handy. But his mental health is clearly not up to par as they keep having to commit him to various psych wards. And by the way, are there no background checks involved? No request for an insurance card? Call me crazy, no pun intended. But being on the run with a teammate who requires this level of mental care seems to me like a liability. And that is what makes me go, about the A-team. Let's take a look at another show. We're going to shift gears here. A little sitcom known as ALF. You know, I went from the A-team to ALF, like you do. There was a very small window of time during which I was a huge fan of ALF. This was one of my favorite shows for a few months in either like the fourth or fifth grade. Oddly, I have hardly any recollection of the show, which is really strange given that almost everything else I've ever watched has like lodged itself firmly in my brain. I remember tuning in every week and having an ALF poster on my bedroom door. I also remember quickly losing interest and bailing on the show long before its finale. I guess it was just a fling rather than a true love affair. Oh well, that's that on ALF. Now here's the deets, the run. ALF premiered on September 22nd, 1986. It lasted 104 episodes over four seasons and ended on March 24th, 1990, an alien from the planet Melmac named Gordon Shumway crash lands into the garage of the Tanner family. They allow him to secretly live with them and refer to him as ALF, which stands for Alien Life Form. ALF proves to be a sarcastic, you know, handful of a guest who often tries to eat their cat. That's the premise. Let's take a look at the cast. Max Wright as the Tanner family patriarch, Willie Tanner. He's going to come up later on in another podcast episode where I look at creepy fellas of the 80s. Ann Sheedon as mom, Kate Tanner. Andrea Elson as oldest child, Lynn Tanner. Benji Gregory as younger child, Brian Tanner. And Paul Fusco as the voice of ALF. He was also, I think, the creator and definitely the producer of the show. Want my thoughts? Well, here they are. we've seen shows like this a bunch. Like, you replace Alf with a robot girl, and you've got Small Wonder. Replace Alf with a witch, and you essentially have Bewitched. Even down to the nosy neighbor, always suspicious of what's going on. Alf had all the funny lines and was the central character of each episode's A storyline. The other actors were simply there to support. So, you know, that is kind of a one-trick pony show. It was all about Alf. Here's some fun facts. The Alf puppet was operated from various trapdoors around the set, which the other actors had to learn to avoid so as not to fall through them. The show's technical demands made for very long shooting schedules, which resulted in a lot of tension between the actors, some of whom described the experience as dysfunctional. Also, the technical demands and long hours made this one of the most expensive sitcoms of its era to produce. Since both puppets and a little person were used to portray Alf, it was decided that the show would not film in front of a live audience so that its secrets wouldn't be revealed to the fans. They didn't want the mystique to be lost, especially for kids. The final episode was intended to be a cliffhanger and even featured the phrase "to be continued," kind of to persuade the network to bring the show back for another season, but alas, it was canceled anyway. A conclusive ending aired 6 years later, right? But did not feature any of the original live actors, so I don't know that anyone cared or even watched it. An animated prequel aired from 1987 to 1989, featuring Alf's life on Planet Melmac. Well, there you go. The show's composer was actually named Alf Clausen. No relation, but I love that the guy working on the show was also named Alf. What are the odds of that? And final fun fact, Alf drank alcohol in the early episodes until NBC demanded that he be more family friendly. And I don't remember that as a kid, but that struck me as funny now. So let's look at a couple things that make me go, about Alf. Obviously, with a show like this, suspension of disbelief is a must. That's given. That said, here are a few things that I couldn't help but overlook. First one, Alf had a name, a surprisingly human American-sounding name, Gordon Shumway. Why the hell did they insist on calling him Alf? Why not Gordon? I would totally get it, right, if his alien name featured letters and sounds that, like, we humans couldn't comprehend or replicate with our voices or our tongues or our throats, whatever. But his fucking name was Gordon. Ignoring that and calling him Alf just seems like a dick move to me, right? I understand your name is Gordon. I'm going to call you alien life form, Alf. I don't know. That just seems like a fucking rude move. Second thing that made me go, one of the primary themes of this show is that Alf needs to be kept a secret from everyone outside the house. An alien spacecraft crashed into their home, and they made the decision to cover it up and make the alien a part of their family. The Tanner family lives in the suburbs of the San Fernando Valley. They have neighbors on either side of them and across the street. One of their neighbors, named Raquel Akmanik, has proven to be very nosy and suspicious of the goings-on within the Tanner home. So, is it really in the best interest of everyone involved to give Alf free range of the house? Really? This little fucker walks around the house all day, unsupervised. He watches TV. He listens to music. He's making sandwiches in the kitchen. He's chasing the cat around the house. Might it be smarter to contain him to the attic or the laundry room or build him a fucking box like you would a rabbit? I don't know. Maybe allow him out when he can be supervised, but otherwise kept in a windowless area of the home, right? They take a very willy-nilly approach toward keeping the secret safe, man. And okay, let's move on. The next show that I would like to talk about, it's one of my faves from my teen years, Married with Children. By the time I was in sixth grade, this show was appointment television for my friends and I. It was also the first show my mother ever banned me from watching, unsuccessfully, I might add. Married with Children felt like a rock and roll concert, man. It was one of the first shows on the brand new Fox network, and it was low budget. It was loud, crude, chock full of sexy ladies. I mean, they really never had anything like it on American television that I could remember. Al Bundy quotes were a regular part of the vernacular with my friends and I, and we could often be heard saying things like, "Whoa, Bundy," or "Out of the way, behemoth," or "Four touchdowns in one game." I mean, that was just stuff me and my friends said to each other all the time. So here are the details. Let's talk about the run. Married with Children premiered on April 5th, 1987. It produced, holy shit, 263 episodes over a whopping 11 seasons and finally concluded on June 9th, 1997, making it the longest-running live-action sitcom in Fox's history. And as you probably know, the longest-running non-live-action sitcom in Fox's history is still going on, and that's The Simpsons. The premise, the Bundy family are like every other family in their quiet Chicago suburban neighborhood, except they are broke, dysfunctional, living under the black cloud of the Bundy curse. They're both feared and looked down upon. The Bundys always band together, like determined to beat the system to get their slice of the American dream. They fight, claw, and cheat their way toward achieving their goal until the rug is inevitably pulled out from under them, and they end up miserable, hungry, and poor, but always, always with enough fight left to get up and try again. So I love the Bundys. Let's talk about the cast. Ed O'Neill as family patriarch Al Bundy. Al, a former high school football star, now sells shoes and wishes each day were his last. Katie Seagal is Al's wife, Peggy. Peggy comes from a white trash hillbilly family in Wanker County, which I think is supposed to be in Wisconsin. She doesn't work or participate in any household chores, but she does look great in her gaudy, skin-tight outfits. Not that Al never notices. I almost said Elf. Not that Al ever notices how good his wife looks, which we'll talk about. Christina Applegate as the dim-witted, slutty daughter, Kelly. I know slutty seems like a harsh word, but this girl really was the neighborhood mattress. All right. That said, she was kind of smart for being dimwitted in that she kind of got one up on everybody. And I think it could have been a much more stereotypical role if played by a different actress. I think Christine Applegate did a really good job of making her kind of always outsmarting men, even though she wasn't that brainy. And then, of course, David Faustino as Bun Bundy, the little smartass who is shockingly smart and also shockingly bad with the ladies. My man's always trying to get laid. So you want my thoughts? Well, here they are. This show ruled. It's often described as a satirical look at sitcom families, but I think it was so much more than that. Like the Bundys, Married with Children did so much with so little. It created an entire Bundy universe. It was low budget, and most of the sets looked like shit, but we didn't care. The audience didn't give a shit. It was over the top, as Al was often blown up or electrocuted. He never ate. He had no money. He was universally disliked and disrespected by everyone, including his own family. Yet he was a hero, kind of. We rallied around him. We cheered for him. He was an underdog, but unlike other underdogs like Rocky or Rudy, we really didn't want to see him win. For us, the real win for Al Bundy was to keep being Al Bundy. Try, fall short, and give the world the middle finger. That's what we loved about Al. Now, Married with Children was ahead of its time in that it was a family of anti-heroes. Of course, anti-heroes are now the go-to lead characters around which most prestige television shows are built. Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, so on. The show became a lightning rod for the moral majority and was protested by conservatives and religious organizations, which only fueled the public's desire to watch. Say what you will about the message of this show, but the family stuck together. The Bundys were like a gang. If you mess with one of them, you mess with all of them. And that, my friends, is what family is all about. So can I get a whoa, Bundy? Let's discuss some fun facts. Ed O'Neill's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame is in front of a shoe store. I've seen it. I always wonder if that was on purpose or not. That always made me laugh. Season 3, E6, was titled Her Cups Runneth Over and was apparently offensive enough to cause a family values activist named Terry Ricolta to start a letter writing campaign to the show's sponsors in an effort to get them to drop their sponsorship and have Fox cancel the show. Some sponsors did cancel, right? But her efforts ultimately had the opposite effect when the story spread across the media, causing the ratings for Married with Children to dramatically increase, making it a major hit for the Fox network. So there you go, Terry. All you did was fuel the fire. Married with Children tried to do a Cousin Oliver twice. First, during season 6, Katie Seagal's real-life pregnancy was written into the show, and the Bundys were going to have a baby. Sadly, Katie in real life miscarried, so the producers made Peggy's pregnancy a dream, and the Bundys never had their little bundle of joy. Later, though, in season 7, Peggy's cousins abandoned their son, Seven, leaving him to be raised by the Bundys. The plan was for this little guy to be the newest, youngest Bundy, but the character was unpopular with fans, so the show aborted the storyline. Get it? Aborted? Well done, Fanacek. Proud of myself. Last fun fact, Married with Children produced a spinoff called Top of the Heap. I've talked about it on the podcast before. It starred a pre-Friends Matt LeBlanc. Luckily for LeBlanc, it sucked and got canceled, leaving him available for future auditions like the one he had for Friends. So let's talk about some things that make you go, I really only have one. And this has bothered me since I was a kid. And I'm sure most fans of this show had this same concern, same query, if you will. One of the running gags on the show is Al being disgusted by even the thought of having sex with Peggy. Despite her best efforts, Al avoids sex with his wife at all costs, and the audience seems to be in agreement with all this. Like, the audience cheers, and it seemed like a joke that everyone was in on. Now, young teenage Fanacek cannot wrap his head around this idea, right? Peggy Bundy's hot. My friend Santo, she wouldn't need to ask me twice about knocking boots, man. But given that even the audience was in on this joke, like I said, and so because the audience was in on the joke, I assumed this was a grown-up thing and that maybe I'd understand when I was older. Nope. Because now I am older and I still don't get it. I'd be all over that if given the chance. The only argument I've heard that it makes even a little sense is that she treats him horribly, so of course he doesn't want to sleep with her. As an adult male, I can tell you with no uncertainty that argument holds zero water. Being nice to us is not a requirement when it comes to getting booty. You can hate us, ridicule us, spit on our mamas. As long as you're willing to have sex, we're in, man. We're all in. Every time I reminisce with friends about this show, we always agree that Al was out of his fucking mind because Peggy Bundy was at peace. So that wraps it up on Married with Children. Let's talk about another show that was like the opposite of Married with Children. I think most shows were actually the opposite of Married with Children. We're going to talk about Growing Pains. Show me that smile again. All right. Growing Pains was a top tier sitcom of the 80s. That said, there's really nothing terribly memorable about it. I say top tier because it was like perennially a top 10 sitcom. And I'm sure if you go back and look at like a list of like top shows of the 80s or top sitcoms of the 80s, top families of the 80s, top dads of the 80s, Growing Pains is always in the mix, but there's really nothing special about it. It followed the same general formula as most: upper middle class family in the suburbs, mom and dad still married and in love, and a few kids, including a delinquent kid, a brainy kid, all that. They pulled the cousin Oliver with baby Chrissy, and then they cousin Olivered the cousin Oliver when they took in a homeless kid played by young Leonardo DiCaprio. So how about that? They even had a spinoff, Just the 10 of Us. So although top tier, there was really nothing too original going on here. It was like it had all the makings of all the other shows it was competing against. Here's some details to discuss the run. Growing Pains premiered on September 24th, 1985, and said goodbye on April 25th, 1992. It aired 167 episodes over 7 seasons. The premise. The show starts when Mom, Maggie, decides to go back to work after staying home for years to raise the kids. To facilitate this, the dad, Jason, he moves his psychiatric practice to a home office so he can work from home and help out around the house, be home when the kids get home from school, all that shit. They have 3 kids. The oldest is often in trouble and gets shitty grades. The middle child is a nerd, and the youngest seems to just scream and eat a lot. I don't know what's going on with him. Let's talk about the cast. Alan Thicke as Jason Seaver. Alan was a prominent talk show host in Canada whose recent attempt at an American late-night talk show called Thick of the Night was a highly publicized failure, unfortunately. So he went from that to being Dad Jason on this show, which was probably a good move. Joanna Kearns as Maggie Seaver. She was the mom. She had blonde hair. That's all I've got about her. I don't know. Kind of not memorable. Although she went on to become a pretty prominent television director, so there you go. Kirk Cameron as oldest child Mike. Kirk became a teen heartthrob and the breakout star of the show. He shit out a few crappy mainstream movies before finding Jesus, becoming born again, and then, you know, shifting his focus to shitting out crappy Christian movies. So that's what he does now. Tracy Gold as middle child Carol. Carol was the brain. Her looks were often the butt of Mike's jokes, which was funny. Right? He made fun of her face and her body. Funny until we learned that Tracy Gold in real life suffered from anorexia. So, yikes, guys. How come no one fucking stepped in to protect her? Then Jeremy Miller as youngest child until Chrissy came later. Ben. Like I said earlier, Ben didn't have much to do on the show besides eat and scream. I had Jeremy Miller on my podcast. So go check it out. It's on my YouTube channel as well. Super nice guy. Really interesting interview. He does not like Corey Haim. So go listen to that interview, if nothing else, just to hear his fucking thoughts on Corey Haim. Oh, excuse me, Corey Feldman. He didn't enjoy Corey Haim, did not like Corey Feldman. And towards the end of my interview with him, he just kind of went on a whole tangent about it. I just sat back and let him talk, man. It's pretty wild. So that is the cast of Growing Pains. Want my thoughts? Well, even if you don't, here they are. This show was fine for what it was. It certainly, again, was a top 10 80s sitcom, but keep in mind that its competitors were basically variations of the same shit. The Cosby Show, Growing Pains, right? The Hogan Family. They're all the same thing. There was nothing edgy about the show. Family Ties is another one. Again, nothing edgy about the show, except for Carol's boyfriend, Sandy, dying as a result of a drunk driving accident. That seemed to be their big thing. And incidentally, Sandy was played by a very young Matthew Perry. So how about that? This show did its job honorably. It amused us for 7 years and then went away. Thanks for the almost laughs, I guess. So there you go. Let's do some fun facts. Most of the primary cast members are from showbiz families. Alan Thicke had his son, Robin Thicke. Joanna Kearns' sister was Sandra Kearns. She was the mom and Charles in charge. Kirk Cameron's sister was Candace Cameron Bure. And Tracy Gold had a sister named Missy Gold, and she was on Benson. So acting families. Alan Thicke co-wrote the theme songs to both Different Strokes and The Facts of Life. How about that? The show returned for two reunion TV movies, Growing Pains the Movie in 2000 and Growing Pains Return of the Seavers in 2004, in which all the cast members came back. Christy Swanson appeared in a 1987 episode and was Alan Thicke's girlfriend at the time. Yikes. They started dating when he was 40 and she was 17. I don't know how I feel about that. Part of me is like, well done, sir. Assuming it's legal. I don't know if it is or not. But anyway, it's kind of creepy, and he's dead now, so it is what it is. Here's something cool. Brad Pitt appeared in two episodes as two different characters. I've talked about that before. Along with the fact that Leonardo DiCaprio is on the show, you got the two leads from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, my favorite movie of all time. So there you go. Last fun fact, Bruce Willis, another Quentin Tarantino alum. Bruce Willis was very close to landing the role of Jason Seaver. How about that? He ended up getting Moonlighting instead. Now, can you imagine Bruce Willis as the dad on an 80s sitcom? I can't do it. I think he would have lasted one season before he was so bored out of his fucking mind and didn't want to do it anymore. So let's look at Growing Pains as things that make you go, starting with this one. Andrew Koenig. Andrew Koenig, son of Star Trek star Walter Koenig. Walter Koenig played Chekhov in Star Trek. Andrew Koenig had a recurring role as Mike Seaver's best friend. His name was Boner. That's right, Boner. Now, this was a family sitcom, and it featured a character named Boner. As if to say, like, we had no idea. There was a flashback scene once depicting the moment when Mike and Boner met as little tykes. They were waiting for the school bus. And according to this scene, Boner introduced himself as Richard Stabone, but Mike just decided Boner would be a fun play on the name Stabone. Stabone, Staboney, Staboner, Boner, whatever. You can't bullshit the audience. Everyone knows what a boner is, right? Including the folks behind Growing Pains. I think it's ironic that Jesus Freak Kirk Cameron had Julie McCulloch fired because he was uncomfortable with her prior appearance in Playboy. Now he's all Jesus-y, but saying the word boner six times in an episode was just fine. So go eat a boner, Kirk Cameron. Incidentally, Andrew Koenig, who played Boner, I knew him at Second City in Los Angeles. He was a really talented improviser, was not the friendliest guy in town. I actually discussed it with Jeremy Miller when he was on my podcast. He wasn't a really nice guy per se, but he did have friends and he was really, really talented. And sadly, he hung himself, I believe in 2010. So I did not know that he had issues going on. I didn't know him terribly well, but I had performed with him on stage a few times. And that is that. Second thing that makes me go, about Growing Pains. Is it a smart move, I'm asking, to run your psychiatric practice out of your house? I don't think guiding people through their mental struggle should be like an at-home business. Jason's office was essentially in the living room. So every day, half a dozen patients would walk in and out, right? Although they never depicted this scenario, I'm also left wondering what the waiting room situation is. Do they just wait in their car until you wave them in, or do they let themselves in and just chill out on the couch until you're ready? I mean, neither option sounds safe to me. Now they know where you live, the layout of the house, what your kids look like, etc. I don't know. Dr. Seaver better bring his A game to every patient, because if he doesn't want to have a sixth sense thing go on where a guy's waiting for him in the bathroom and shoots him, because they know where he lives and they're in his house all the time. And that is Growing Pains. The next show I want to talk about is long been forgotten history, and it is My Two Dads. Like I said, this was a fun little show that has largely been forgotten, and I really don't know what the hell else to say about it. So let's just start with the details. The run. It premiered September 20th, 1987, and produced 60 episodes over three seasons. The finale aired April 30th, 1990. The premise of the show, when Marcy Bradford dies, she leaves her teenage daughter in the custody of two ex-boyfriends, neither of them whom the girl has ever met nor heard of. One is straight-laced businessman Michael, The other is a free-spirited artist named Joey. Michael and Joey decide to live together in New York City and raise young Nicole. Marcy did not know which ex-boyfriend was a biological father, and neither do they. So have fun, everyone. Jesus. Let's talk about the cast before I circle back on that fucking premise. The cast. Stacey Keenan as Nicole Bradford. Little girl. She was cute. She did a good job. Stacey would go on to co-star in that Brady Bunch ripoff Step by Step. Paul Reiser, an early Paul Reiser project as Michael Taylor. Paul was already a successful stand-up comic and a successful movie actor, really, because he appeared in Beverly Hills Cop and Aliens. He was in the second Alien movie. I'm not sure why he chose to do this show, but who am I to question the great Paul Reiser? And then Greg Evigan as artist Joey Harris. Greg was the star of BJ and the Bear. So unlike Paul Reiser, this was a step up. BJ and the Bear, not one of my favorite shows. You want my thoughts? Well, here they are. The premise of this show is fucking ridiculous. The two men inherit a little girl they didn't know existed and is likely, only likely, one of their daughters. The judge who made this happen owns the building in which they live and supervises their parenting. At Nicole's request, the little girl, right, the men never use a DNA test to determine paternity. So just to recap real quick, these two men are given a girl to raise, are not sure if they're the father, they follow the young girl's orders not to determine paternity, and all the while, a judge is supervising their parenting and also serving as their landlord. This sounds like hell. And just to put the cherry on top of this poor decision Sunday, artist Joey later leaves New York City, moves to San Francisco to live with his girlfriend and her daughter, which means he went from raising a girl that might not be his to raising a girl that definitely isn't his. What the fuck's going on here? Anyway, fun facts. I only have two. I don't know. I'd have a lot of fun doing this one. Greg Evigan sang the theme song. So I guess he's a dual threat kind of a performer. I don't know. Shitty sitcom actor and singer. The working title of the show was Who's Dad? I guess that's better than My Late Mom Was a Whore. That made me laugh. And I'm having fun. Later on NBC, My Late Mom Was a Whore, starring blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Paul Reiser in My Late Mom Was a Whore. That's funny. Okay. Things that make you go, There's a lot here. The whole show makes me go, But here we go. First one. Can a judge really force two men to raise a little girl just because they had a sexual relationship with her mother 13 years earlier? Does this sound at all like a fair deal to them or to the girl for that matter? Also, can that same judge also continuously supervising their parenting, always threatening to take the girl away while also serving as their landlord? Are there any laws or boundaries here? Because this sounds like it's very unfair. Second thing, let's discuss the DNA test. I understand why Nicole didn't want a DNA test. I do. That would mean one man would be proven not to be her father, and she loved them both equally. So she didn't want one man that relationship to change. Understood. It would be heartbreaking. You know what else is heartbreaking, though? Here's a list of heartbreaking things. Forcing two men to live with each other and raise a daughter that might not be theirs. Do you know how often they will have to tell this crazy story? Every time they meet a new girlfriend, or attend a social gathering, or office parties, they're inevitably going to be asked things like, do you have kids? Or are you gay? Because I see that you're in your mid-30s and live with another dude. Right? And every time this comes up, they will have to look someone in the eyes and give them the crazy premise of this sitcom. What woman would ever date one of these guys? What the fuck's going on here? Another thing that's heartbreaking, not knowing your medical history. Does my family have a history of heart disease or glaucoma? I have no clue because my mom is dead and I don't know who my fucking biological father is. So those are heartbreaking things. Here's the third thing though that makes me go, about this show. Won't she start to look like one of these fuckers at some point anyway? I mean, isn't the cat going to be out of the bag? Because look, one of them is 6'2 and the other's 5'7. At some point, she may not need a test anyway. So why not get ahead of this situation, right? Why not start to control the narrative here? But that wraps up things that make you go, about my two dads. Here's another 80s classic. Another one, it's funny, a lot of these shows were classics, but they didn't really survive much in syndication. And this one is Head of the Class. Now, Head of the Class is currently being talked about quite a bit as I record this because of that that documentary about Nickelodeon and Dan Schneider, which we'll get to. This show was a very, very run-of-the-mill sitcom, like Blossom. It produced enough episodes to go into syndication, but it simply disappeared when it went off the air. unlike Blossom, it limped across that 100 episode finish line. And I guess I understand why it just went away. Because I mean, I think they had actually fight and claw to get it to 100 episodes. Because that's where the money is once you get to 100 episodes. Blossom was a hit show. This one I think was like kind of done in its 80s, but did what it could to get over 100. In short though, this show was inferior to Blossom. Not sure how this became about Blossom. Head of the Class has a lot of buzz, or had a lot of buzz basically when it premiered because it was the return of WKRP's Howard Hessman. So everyone was excited about that. In the end, it did its job, nothing more, nothing less. Let's discuss the details. It premiered on September 17th, 1986. Produced 114 episodes over five seasons. It said goodbye on June 25th, 1991. Here's the premise. A struggling actor named Charlie Moore becomes a substitute teacher for a class of academically exceptional students at a New York City public school. Although prodigies, most of the kids lack social skills, so Mr. Moore has a positive influence on their non-academic life and becomes their full-time teacher whilst butting heads with the principal, Dr. Samuels. Later, Mr. Moore gets his big break on Broadway and he leaves, so he's replaced by a Scottish dude named Billy McGregor. That's the overall premise. We'll come back to it. Let's take a look at the cast. It's a long cast because a lot of people on the show. Howard Hessman as Charlie Moore. Again, he was coming off his run as Dr. Johnny Fever on WKRP in Cincinnati. Sir Billy Connolly as Charlie Moore's Scottish replacement in the later seasons. I think only the final season, really. His name was Billy McGregor. This is a great example of a Scottish comedian playing a Scottish comedian. William J. Schilling as the principal, Dr. Harold Samuels. Janetta Arnett, that's a fucking crazy name. Janetta Arnett as assistant principal and love interest to Charlie Moore, Bernadette Mira. Well, there you go. Dan Schneider, yikes. Dan Schneider as Dennis Blunden. Dennis was the fat guy in the back of the room that later became an inappropriate writer-producer of kid shows on Nickelodeon. He'll come up here in a little bit. Brian Robbins as smart-ass, tough guy student Eric Mardian. He's basically Vinnie Barbarino with some brains. He later became an appropriate writer-director of kids shows on Nickelodeon as he was Dan Schneider's partner for a long time, but I guess he wasn't an a-hole. Dan Frischman as Arvin Engen. It's like Central Casting sent him over from the stereotypical nerd division. I mean, this kid, if he didn't get this part, he would have been starring in a Revenge of the Nerds TV show or something. Robin Givens as Darlene Merriman. Robin Givens was a BOOF candidate, I believe. I have no recollection of her character's qualities, but this chick was married to and took a beating from Mike Tyson. So that made her famous. Sadly, she kind of came out looking like the bad guy in her divorce from Tyson. Not sure how that worked. I'm not sure how she was the bad guy in that scenario. But she took a beating from him, came out looking bad. I guess it's a man's world, as they say. Christine Hodge as flower child Simone Foster. There was a lot of will there, won't they, between her and Eric, the tough guy. And she was pretty red-haired girl. I liked her a lot. Tony O'Dell as Alan Pinkard. Look, this character was totally bland and forgettable, but this actor was one of the Cobra Kai and the Karate Kid. He was the one that was bland and forgettable. So I guess that's his thing, being bland and forgettable. But he was one of the Cobra Kai. Kimberly Russell as Sarah Nevins. She smiled a lot. That's all I remember about her. She was Bill Cosby's daughter in Ghost Dad. So yeah, there's that too. And otherwise, I don't know anything about Kimberly Russell. Tanis Vallely. She played the 10-year-old prodigy Janice Lazzarato. She didn't have much to do. 10-year-olds in high school TV shows don't get good storylines, sadly, so that's about that for her. Leslie Bega was the hottie Maria Borges, and if I recall, she was pretty emotional and had some anxiety issues, but forget all that. This chick later played one of Tony Soprano's Gumars, man, which makes her a legend. She was the one that he stole from Ralph Cifaretto, the Cuban girl. So anyway, that's Leslie Bega. And then I got a couple more here. Johair Coleman as Jawaharlal Chowdhury. He was the token Indian guy. He had to, and this is true, he had to darken his skin for each episode. And I wish I were kidding about that. So that shit would not fly today. But anyway, now there were several other kids that joined the cast over the years, but I don't feel like going too deeply into them. So here they are real quick. Rain Pryor, that was Richard Pryor's daughter. Michael DiLorenzo, he was in Michael Jackson's Beat It video. He later starred in a show called New York Undercover. Laura Piper. She had blonde hair. That's all I know on her. Devereaux White. He was the limo driver in Die Hard. So he's kind of cool. He played a character named Aristotle. And then Kai-Hu Kwan, he won an Academy Award in 2023 for Best Supporting Actor in Everything Everywhere All at Once. He was also in The Goonies and Indiana Jones and The Temple of Doom. He eventually joined this cast as well. So that is the cast of Head of the Class. Want my thoughts? Well, here they are. Again, this show is nothing more than capable. It probably deserved a syndication run, but it's a moot point now, given that the series star Dan Schneider is currently the subject of a docuseries detailing his offensive and inappropriate behavior on his Nickelodeon set, particularly with children. So there you go. So goodbye, Dan Schneider. You had a good run, but you are now canceled. See you on the flippity flip. Outside of Dan Schneider's now Cosby-esque legacy, the cast of this show is easily the best thing Head of the Class had going for it. It's not easy to make a series largely set in one room consistently watchable and interesting. So generally, shows like this eventually change the locale or they jump the shark to keep viewers interested. This show simply just swapped out cast members every now and then, which worked well because that's exactly what happens in a real high school and in life, right? The cast just keeps changing, right? That's how life works. The cast always changes. It's a Hallmark moment. Fun facts. Howie Mandel was considered as a replacement when Howard Hessman left, and he didn't do it. Billy Connolly's character got a spinoff after Head of the Class went off the air. It was called Billy, and it lasted only 13 episodes. So there you go. Last fun fact. Head of the Class was rebooted in 2021 for HBO Max with all new cast and everything. It got canned after only 10 episodes. So people just don't care about Head of the Class. Now, I've got two things that make me go, Okay, first one. This was a class full of prodigies. Geniuses, in fact, right? How is it then that I understood every lesson they were taught? There was not one fucking thing that those teachers taught those kids that I didn't understand 100%. And let me tell you, I'm not exactly an academic god. I'm a guy who devoted 30,000 words to a supporting character in the movie Teen Wolf. That's who I am. These writers gave almost zero effort to making this class seem like it was intellectually stimulating. So, like, take a look at The Big Bang Theory, for example. I 100% believe that those men and women are geniuses because I don't know what the fuck is going on while they're debating physics, engineering, comic books, all that stuff, right? But it's still funny. It still works. I'm pretty sure I could have hung in there with these guys and Head of the Class. Here's a simple Fanchek rule of thumb. If I can understand everything you are saying, you are not that smart. So that is the first thing that makes me go, I mean, their history lessons were so basic. George Washington, he crossed the Delaware. I said, well, no shit. You don't need a brainiac to know that. The second thing that made me go, Now, this opinion is going to be tricky. I don't want to play into stereotypes, nor do I want to offend anyone. But okay, here it goes. This is a class of high-achieving prodigies in New York City, which is a massive cultural hub. And there's only one Indian kid? Only one? Seriously? And no Asians until season 4? And that was only after the Indian guy left. Let's get serious here. This class would have been 99% Asian and Indian. Maybe a token white person, maybe. I'd say some Jewish kids would have been there too, but let's face it. They're not going to public school, not New York City anyway. And there's no way in hell the parents of these high achievers are allowing their little darlings to be taught by an out-of-work actor. And what school district would allow a principal to hire this starving artist as a teacher for anything other than drama? I mean, these kids are featured prominently around the city. They compete in regular academic competitions. Are school officials really going to entrust this man with the molding of these young, important minds? I don't know. That might have been three opinions there, but that wraps up things that make you go, with Head of the Class. Now, the last show I want to discuss. Is it the last show? Let me look here. I think it is. So the last one is another classic. We're going to spend some time on it, and it's Full House. So let's wrap this episode up by dissecting Full House. This show has some serious staying power, and I'm not really sure why. It's fine enough, I guess, but like, why is this show still crushing in syndication, crushing with a Netflix continuation series, and just generally still remaining relevant in pop culture? The jokes were lame, the kids were featured way too much, and the too often very special episodes lacked balls, right? They never once featured a pedophile bicycle shop owner with a room full of wine and porn. They didn't go that far, but here we are in 2024, and that house is still full. Bum, 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 bum. Here's the deets. The Run. A whopping 193 episodes of the original show were produced, starting with the pilot, which aired on September 22nd, 1987. 8 seasons later, the finale hit the airwaves on May 23rd, 1995, a month before Fanichek graduated high school. Here's the premise. Danny Tanner is a recent widow with a widower. Oh, shit. Is he a widower or a widow? Girls' widows? Black widow? Yeah, he's a widower. So I'm glad you got to listen to me figure that shit out. See, I told you I wouldn't have belonged in head of the class. Danny Tanner's a recent widower with 3 young daughters. His brother-in-law, Jesse, and his best friend, Joey, agree to move in with him and help him raise those girls. Here's the cast. Admittedly, this cast is very likable and probably the reason this show won't go away. I'm going to go a little deeper on this cast in a later chapter, so let's not spend too much time here. Bob Saget as widowed father Danny Tanner. Quick story. I've told this story before, but quick story about Bob Saget. I saw him perform some pretty raunchy stand-up back in 2005 at the Laugh Factory on Sunset Boulevard there in Hollywood. He actually opened for, Dane Cook. And it was capacity seating. I mean, everyone was there to see Dane Cook. And so Bob Saget got up, did his thing, and it was pretty raunchy, and it was fine. He got off stage, and from where I was sitting, I could see the whole backstage area. I mean, like, and the side. And if you've been to Laugh Factory, you kind of know what I'm talking about. It's like a big hallway. And so he got off. Danny Cook comes on to perform. And the whole time Danny Cook's performing, there are just hundreds of people backstage or on the side talking to Bob Saget, wanting his autograph, wanting his photograph with him, all that shit. And I'm watching this go down, and I'm like, surely at some point he's going to have to say, okay, guys, I'm leaving. He never did. That dude sat there and met with every single fan, took every picture, signed every autograph. I don't know. Pretty cool. And I've liked him ever since. Sadly, we lost him too soon. He was 65 years old when he died, alone in a hotel room. That really sucks. But that's my Bob Saget story. John Stamos as Uncle Jesse. I'm heterosexual. I promise. But even I would be willing to bang this dude, right? The first season, though, was tough because he had a mullet. He was rocking this crazy mullet in season one. He eventually got his shit together, got a haircut, and then became an ageless icon. Dave Coulier as my least favorite stand-up comedian ever, Joey Gladstone. I have so many questions about this dude. He has zero edge. His go-to jokes involved impressions of Popeye and Rocky and Bullwinkle. Those are animated characters that no American, anyway, had given a shit about since the 60s. I don't understand. Even in Full House World, he was lame. Also, how could this guy ever inspire Alanis Morissette or any other woman to write such an angry, scornful breakup song? Like, Dave Coulier doesn't seem like he even gets hard-ons. But anyway, that's that. Candace Cameron, now Candace Cameron Bure, because she married Pavel Bure's little brother. I don't know his name. She played the oldest child, DJ Tanner. Candace is the kid sister of our favorite judgy Bible thumper, Kirk Cameron. I don't know what else to say about this character. She had nice hair, I think, right? DJ had nice hair. That's about it. Jodie Sweetin as middle child Stephanie. Stephanie was actually one of the first actors, or Jodie anyway, was one of the first actors cast on the show. She ranks pretty high, I have to say, on the list of kid stars with big personalities. Interesting stuff here. Jodie Sweetin was born in prison to an addict. She was then adopted. She was an addict herself for a lot of years, and now she's clean, and she helps others get clean. She's kind of a pretty cool chick, really, but you never would know from little Stephanie Tanner, born in prison, man. How about that? The Olsen twins, Mary-Kate and Ashley, they're not technically identical, but I sure as fuck can't tell them apart, nor do I care. Talk about a lucky break, though. Their mom brought them into the casting session, right? They were a couple months old, along with all these other sets of twins. And these girls got the gig because they happened to be not fussy at the moment. Like they were the only set of twins at that moment, not crying. So think about that. What, 2 careers came out of that moment. 3, if you count their sister Elizabeth Olsen. That's kind of nuts. And then there's booth candidate Lori Loughlin as Jesse's lady Aunt Becky. Lori Loughlin has 2 brilliant student-athlete daughters, both of whom earned scholarships to USC. So well done, Lori Loughlin. All right, want my thoughts on the show? I was an avid viewer of Full House for the first few seasons when I was still young and I spent my Friday nights watching the TGIF lineup. By 1993, my Friday nights were spent drinking in the park with my pals and I never gave the show a second thought. Years later, I started watching again with my oldest daughter when she graduated from cartoons to live action shows. Thank God, right? I stopped watching fucking Caillou and Mickey Mouse Clubhouse and I started getting to watch Aunt Becky. So that was a step up. My first thought, though, when rewatching was how much fun the cast seemed to be having. It's clear that everyone genuinely liked each other and they were having a good time working together. And again, this cast and its obvious chemistry, to me, is likely why the show lasted so long. It's still lame though, so there's that. Let's do some fun facts. Sharon Tate and four other people were killed by the Manson family on August of 1969 in the home of Sharon's husband, Roman Polanski. He was renting the house, but they were killed in that home, rented by Roman Polanski. Years later, that home was torn down and a new Italian-style villa was built. It was like something like $15 million, some crazy price. And you could oversee all of Los Angeles from up there. Full House creator Jeff Franklin eventually lived in that villa. So that's my tie-in to Sharon Tate to Full House. Mary-Kate Olsen is left-handed, while Ashley is right-handed. And if you watch the show closely, you'll see that the character Michelle eats and writes with both hands. That's why. At first, producers didn't want the audience to know that Michelle was played by twins. So she was credited as Mary-Kate Ashley Olsen. Like one word. Or one name, rather. I remember thinking that this little girl has the longest fucking name I've ever seen. Again, I was young. I'm like 12 years old, 11, 10 when this came out. I don't know. And I'm like, Jesus, like Mary-Kate Ashley Olsen, that's a long name. The credits were later changed, though, to show that it was, in fact, two actors. I think it went from Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen. Things that make you go, I have three. I think I have three. Do I have more? No, I have three. Okay. I understand that the entire premise of this show rests on the idea that Jesse and Joey agreed to move in with Danny to help him raise three young daughters. That part makes sense. But here are three things about this that I can't wrap my non-head of the class brain around. One, why did Jesse and Joey stay so long? The need for extra help diminished dramatically over time. Those kids grew up. DJ only appeared sporadically in the final season because she was away at college. Stephanie was a teenager, and Michelle, while still young, was 9 years old and capable of being a latchkey kid if necessary and making herself a fucking PB&J if she were hungry. And to be fair, excuse me, I had a burp there. And to be fair, Danny was often home. It's not like this guy was a traveling salesman. He was the host of a local morning show, meaning he was often home well before dinner. So why the need for all this continued support? That's the first question. Here's my second question. Was this house built by the same contractors as the Huxtable home? Meaning, how is it capable of continuing to allow more and more people to move in? We start with Jesse and Joey. Later, Aunt Becky moves in. Before you know it, she craps out a set of twins. That's now seven people. Seven people in a thin townhome. In reality, it would take about 5 days before everyone started hating each other. There's too many people in this house. Just like the Huxtables, man. Keep moving people in, moving people in, moving people in. It's all nonsense. My third and final thing that makes me go, about this whole scenario. Do either Jesse or Joey have any desire to move on with their lives? Joey is a dorky, not terribly successful stand-up comic, slash DJ, slash advertising guy, slash whatever fucking job they decided to give him to keep the character relevant. I doubt the women are banging down his door for a date. If he ever wants to get married and start a family, is living in the Tanner basement really going to help his cause? I say nay. Speaking of getting married and starting a family, Jesse does just that. And he moves his family of four to the attic. The fucking attic. The only time a family of four should live in an attic is if they're being written about in Anne Frank's fucking diary. That's the only time. That's an awful joke. But geez, it's true. Look, I understand we have to keep the cast together for the purpose of the show. I get that. But why not have Jesse and Aunt Becky like move next door? Kind of like Gloria and Meathead did in All the Family, right? We could write a scenario where the house next door is for sale. Fucking Danny gives them a couple grand for the down payment. Now they live next door and da-da-da instead of the fucking basement, right? And maybe have Joey live in the attic. Which, as I say, that doesn't sound much better than the basement. So maybe they should just get rid of fucking Joey. Just get rid of that character for fuck's sake. But anyway, that is what makes me go, about Full House. And that, folks, wraps up this episode of Fanacek. That was season 5, episode 9. That was things that make you go, about some of my favorite 80s shows. So thank you for listening. If you like the show, rate it, review it. Hit me up on Facebook. I'm Real Fanacek. You can email me, fanacekpodcast@gmail.com. I'm sometimes on Twitter or X, whatever the fuck it's called. I'm not very active on there, but I am there at Fanacek Podcast. Hit me up any one of those ways. Facebook's the best way. But if you want stickers or if you have ideas for the show, if you want to be on the show, hit me up. I'd love to have you on it. I have a YouTube channel. Go to YouTube and search Fanacek. You will see some of my celebrity interviews, including the one with Jeremy Miller that I discussed in this episode. But here's really what I need you to do. You know what it is? I give you the same ask every time, but I'm asking that you stay tuned for the next exciting episode of
Fanny Check.